My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters, the podcast. This week we dive into one of my favourite ever cases on alleged poltergeist infestation, the Enfield Poltergeist. Now, many of you may only be aware of this case thanks to the second Conjuring film, yet this film and the Warren's version's events are simply nonsense. It's scandalous that people who spent less than one day at the property have somehow created a false history of the Enfield Poltergeist. The only people who fully investigated the case were two gentlemen, Maurice Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair, both of whom were sadly no longer with us. Originally, when I first moved to doing this podcast about 5 years ago, the very first interview that I had arranged was with Guy Lyon Playfair. But unfortunately, I became extremely ill and life got in the way for 2 or 3 years, so I had to shelve launching the podcast. And obviously Guy passed away at the beginning of last year, so it's something I'll always regret. But it's also one of the biggest inspirations for me keeping on doing what I'm doing now. Sometimes you've just got to grab life by the horns and just do it. Do something you've always wanted to do, and don't put it off. There's no time to be afraid. The Enfield Poltergeist is probably the most well-investigated case of its kind in the English-speaking world. And Gross and Playfair recorded over 400 hours of incidents, interviews and alleged communication with whatever lurks in that house for the best part of 18 months, from August 1977 to the Easter of 1979. It arrived with a bang, and by the time the Warrens turned up, it had already finished with a whimper. These recordings were passed to Dr. Melvin Willin, the archivist for the Society for Psychical Research, and he has undertook the painstaking task of transcribing and digitising this record. It is this incredible piece of work that has been collected in his new book, The Enfield Poltergeist Tapes, which is available through Amazon. Or, if you want an autographed copy, Dr. Willin has very kindly suggested that you can email us here at mysteriesandmonsters@gmail.com and we will pass your request on to him direct and he will arrange that for you. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube and rate and review us on whichever podcast platform you use to find us. Thanks for listening. Now, let's take a trip back to August 1977 and the beginning of a nightmare for the Hodgson family as the Enfield Poltergeist moves in and begins its reign of terror. Right, my guest today is Dr. Melvin Willin, Dr. Willin has been involved in the research of alleged paranormal phenomena for over the last 25 years. He is the Honorary Archives Liaison Officer, as well as being a council member of the Society of Psychical Research and a consultant for the Ghost Club. He's also a friend of the two key investigators in the Enfield Poltergeist case, the sadly departed Maurice Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair, and it is due to this relationship that he's become the custodian of the tapes from the investigation, which have been the basis for his fantastic and forensic new book, The Enfield Poltergeist Tapes. Dr. Willin, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure so far.
Hey, I'm looking forward to this conversation. So, I think it's probably one of the most well-known poltergeist cases of all time, really, I think, through both positive and negative reasons. I mean, you had a very brief kind of involvement in the case when it actually happened. So when you came back to look at this, and obviously the basis for your the new book, what was the reason that you thought we deserved to have a look at a sort of forensic analysis of the recordings?
Well, what happened was, I, like many other people, by the way, can you hear me okay? Because my screen's frozen.
Yeah, no, you're fine, don't worry.
Okay, great. Like many other people that didn't really know anything about the case, I made my mind up that it was probably just a couple of girls fooling about and thought that's the end of it. Well, then, sadly, just before he died, Maurice Gross, who I was friendly with, said to me, would I take his cassette tapes and listen to them, transcribe them, digitalize them so they'd be there for posterity? I agreed to do this. He sadly died soon after that. And I thought, wow, there's so much more on these tapes that should be brought to public attention than what's just appeared in various articles and of course, Guy's book.
Yeah.
14 months ago, exactly the same happened with Guy.
Yes.
Sadly, he passed away. And he, before he died, also said, would I be willing to take on board the tapes as a custodian? He left them to the Society for Psychical Research. And I set about transcribing them and listening to them. And so I then got about 400 hours of cassette tape whizzing through my mind, thinking, well, a lot of this hasn't appeared, so let's see if anybody's interested in it. White Crow, the publishers, then agreed with me that they would publish the book. And that's what's out there now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those things because it's often put forward as one of the best recorded alleged poltergeist phenomenon cases that we've ever had, especially in the modern era. So when you got hold of the tapes, and like you say, before you got those, you were, you know, there is you are not the only person who thinks this was purely down to Janet and Margaret. How long was it before, whilst you were listening to some of the tapes, that perhaps you started to open up to the possibility that not everything was mischief making?
Sure. Well, it was slowly but surely, shall we say, because amongst all of the undoubted fooling about and the rubbish and the chaos that was going on, there were just little nuggets that I thought, now, hang on a minute here. What's going on there? And it wasn't necessarily the case that the things that are highlighted. So often people go on about their funny voices.
Yeah.
Personally, I wasn't that impressed with the voices. I know Guy and Maurice were, but I personally wasn't. But some of the other things that were recorded on the tapes, where you hear poltergeist in action, you hear things flying around, you hear people saying, well, the girls are nowhere near the objects that are being thrown or the furniture. There was a fish tank lid that was extremely heavy that got thrown across the room. Piping that was wrenched from the wall, you know. None of this seemed to me as being possible through just a couple of kids mucking about.
I think that's one of the things that's always struck me, and it's not just the Enfield case, I think, that this can apply to, that on occasions it's often found that, you know, something's been constructed or we have a false narrative of an actual event. But as you refer to, I think one of the striking incidents that happened at Enfield is like you say, it was the upstairs fireplace, I think, that was just ripped from the wall. I'd like to say that's not the kind of thing, you know, a fully grown man could probably get achieve. So I've always found it peculiar that people say, oh yeah, well, it was all faked, and it's all, you know, it was just down to the two girls, when there's clearly physically strange things that have happened that beg a belief.
Yes, indeed they do. And okay, one can not believe somebody's opinion, but when you've got tape recordings, if anybody says to me, well, I don't believe that happened, I can point to a tape and say, well, there it is, you listen to it. You know, as to how the things happened, now that's a different matter. Mm. I don't know whether things were being manufactured to be thrown across the room or not, but I do know that on the tapes you hear things flying across the room, and you hear the commentary saying that the girls are nowhere near them. Mm. And you even hear one of the girls saying, well, I couldn't have done that, could I, sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose it's one of those interesting aspects of this case is that, yes, you know, there probably was a bit of play acting, and you know, it was a very tense situation for the whole family, and perhaps they were in enjoying the attention and visitors, because it, you know, it's when you read through your book, you don't really, I think, fully understand just how many people wanted to come and see these girls.
Oh, there were many, many different people, and for different reasons, no doubt, and different. Mm. Professions. So, I mean, there were scientists of various characters. There were stage magicians. There were mediums. There were just normal people that were intrigued by it all. There were people from other countries. There was a professor from Japan came across. Two or three from America. The list is endless, really, of the different people that visited there.
Yeah, and I think it's as I've heard Guy say previously in some of the interviews he'd done over the last sort of 15 years, as this case became more well known for anybody outside, probably outside of the UK, I would imagine. He's always been very positive about the whole thing, but I think until I'd read your book, I wasn't aware of the actual volume of people, because it seems at one point there's an endless procession of people just coming, just, you know, sort of popping in, as it were.
Yes, it was, alas, at times a bit like a circus. So you've got, you know, roll up, and who's the next person to come along and witness things? And, of course, once somebody had spent half an hour or an hour there, they formed their opinion based on the hour, let's say, that they were in the place, whereas Guy and Morris were there for hundreds of hours, if not thousands of hours.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, that's something we often see in modern paranormal investigation shows, regardless of the validity of what they actually are. But it always seems, you know, like you say there, people would just turn up in Enfield and say, right, well, I've been here 40 minutes and clearly there's nothing happening here. It's just these two girls vying for people's attention. But as you say, obviously, Morris and Guy were there for the best part of 14 months on and off. And like you say, you'd got such a volume of recordings and stuff that often I think people expect cases like this, that it's happening all the time and it's consistent. But obviously, because of the sporadic nature of this phenomena, it was only because they were there so long that we probably got as many incidents and reports as we have.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, there were times when nothing happened whatsoever, and learned professors would say, well, there's nothing going on here, because nothing happened for the hour or two they were there. And as soon as they walked out the door, all hell would let loose.
There is often the case, it would seem. And I think, do you think the fact that more often than not, things didn't happen on demand, that lots of people came away from Enfield thinking it was nothing. Do you think that perhaps strengthens Morris and Guy's investigation, because things didn't go on as often as perhaps people expected it to, or that things didn't happen regardless? Or do you think that just proved that maybe the more people were there, the less attempt was made for mischief?
Well, my honest answer has to be I don't know. Mm. because I don't know. I do know that they got a bit fed up with the number of people that were condemning it after having been there for a short amount of time. Mm. I also know through the tapes. Everything I'm saying, by the way, is because of the tapes. My own opinion is only as worthwhile as anybody else's opinion is. But certainly on the tapes, there are times when the girls are playing around, that they admit to playing around. They get caught out playing around. And it would be surprising, as Guy and Morris often said, if they didn't play around, these were relatively normal, youngish children, and youngish children fool around. So why wouldn't they try some of the things on? Especially if somebody was there that they sort of were interested in and they wanted to sort of put on a good show for them and nothing was happening spontaneously, then they might have given it a nudge.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's always kind of, because obviously I think, you know, we've seen a lot of famous cases of a similar nature. I mean, Amityville is probably the prime example of essentially a series of events which, when one scrutinises, especially Amityville, there's absolutely no evidence that any of the incidents happened whatsoever. And obviously, we've got the famous court case where they basically admitted it was fraud. And yet, here we are 40 years later, and people are still promoting Amityville as one of the best recorded hauntings of all time, despite the fact that there is zero evidence that anything happened at all, and they admitted that it was all done for money.
I couldn't possibly comment on any of that.
I mean, I'm only going on the court transcripts from 1979, so that's why I'm alleging it. And obviously, the Lutz family lost that court case.
Yes, I give Amityville to Amityville, to be honest.
So, I think it's one of those strange things that it would have been easier for them. For them to have continued to do stuff, and I know there are certain aspects that, you know, you've always got to question any incident that happens behind a closed door, which happened on occasion. But I think when you look at the balance of evidence that happened to people that had no direct connection with the family, as in a relative or a neighbour, I think they are the more intriguing witness aspects to the whole case for me, such as, you know, I think the policewoman was called Caroline Heaps.
That's right, yes.
I mean, so either she basically made that up and it never happened, or she clearly saw something extremely peculiar and I would surmise rather terrifying.
Yes, I have quite a bit of respect. I've never met the lady concerned, but I have respect for the fact that she evidently put this down in her pocketbook, which is what the police are meant to do as soon as they've witnessed something. And she was also interviewed, I think it was on a TV program at one point, where she reiterated what she'd seen. And this sort of activity was, as you just said, it was corroborated by a whole load of other people that had nothing to gain from it other than ridicule from their colleagues. So, I mean, the lollipop lady is the famous example where she believes that she saw Janet levitating. And people could have thought, well, this woman is mad saying something like this. But she held to her viewpoint that that's what she'd seen. Local baker was another person who verified that he'd seen that sort of activity from Janet going on from the outside, and loads and loads of other people. Mrs. Hodgson's brother witnessed a massive amount. The next door neighbours did. You know, it wasn't just the inner family plus Guy and Morris.
I think that's the other thing. I think that because the baker and the lollipop lady essentially see, is it the same incident they both see but neither realise that the other one has seen it? Or were they two, because that's the one thing I've never been able to sort of clarify in regards to this, Dr. Willen. Did they both report seeing the same thing despite the fact that neither of them realised the other one was watching the same thing at the same time?
I am led to believe that from what's on the tapes, yes.
Yeah, because it's very interesting that out of everybody that's ever spoken about the case, I mean, obviously, the baker was extremely traumatised. You would perhaps say he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, because he was very, very emotionally affected by the incident as a witness.
Sorry, I interrupted you there because I recently, about 2 months ago, I managed to make contact with his wife. And I was asking for people to bring me up to date, really, 40 years on.
Yeah.
And she said that, sadly, I won't name the name, but he had died recently. But that up to his dying day, he was still sort of thinking about what he'd seen that day and believing that he'd seen something that was genuinely paranormal. And she reiterated that, and I've got it in writing in the letter that she wrote to me.
Yeah. I mean, it would be very easy. I mean, the other aspect to this as well is because it would be very easy for some of these witnesses these days. I mean, you know, it's 40 years ago. It would be very easy for them to either ignore any kind of correspondence in regards to yourself or anybody else wanting to continue this investigation. Yet they haven't changed the story. And like you say, he was absolutely adamant to his dying day what he'd seen.
Yes, that's the case. And numerous other people that I also wrote to, I mean, most of them actually replied to me, which was pleasing. There were some that I didn't get any reply from at all, which was disappointing. Mm. But a lot of the people maintained that, yes, they still had the same belief now, 40 years on, but they just expanded in some of their letters, which I've actually quoted in the book.
Mm. I mean, I think that's one of those things that, like I say, it would be very easy, and I think that's testament to, because clearly people still feel very passionate about this incident and what happened, you know, how it affected them, regardless of the fact, you know, they weren't stuck in the middle of the maelstrom as the family were. Yet they still were great, deeply and greatly affected by even just by passing incidents, really.
Yes, I mean, people were just about displayed every emotion that you can think about. Some people were scared by it. Some people were intrigued or excited by it. Some people, notably Mrs. Hodgson, was just fed up with the whole thing. I mean, she was trying to hold this family together as a single parent. She was very tired. She was being kept awake for a lot of the night because of the activity that was going on. She was trying to make ends meet financially. This was a drain on their finance because things kept getting broken.
Mm.
You know, so I think her main emotion was just utter tiredness with it and just wanting it to be over as quickly as possible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the other interesting aspects for me about the case is that when Morris and Guy eventually joins him, you know, fairly shortly after it, Morris turns up there, but there was a very tense kind of financial family situation. Obviously, the family had a mother had recently got divorced, I think, was it within the previous 2 years? So
yeah,
financially there was a lot of stress and strain on there, you know, single mum, four kids. You know, a couple of issues with, you know, both boys. I think, was it Jimmy was a boarding school for behavioural issues, and Billy had a speech defect that caused him some issues at his school as well.
Yeah, it was Johnny, actually.
Oh, my apologies.
He's the one at the special school, yeah.
Yeah, Johnny, not Jimmy, my apologies. So clearly there was a lot of tension building in that family unit.
Yes, and some people say that the tension and the stress that they were undergoing was one of the reasons why these events were happening, because it built up to a head and some sort of psychic event was caused by the stress that was happening in the family.
It's basically something like a powder keg just going off, because it was, you know, the tension was affecting everybody. And like you say, they weren't financially in a position, you know, to be throwing items around the house. They weren't well off, you know what I mean? It was a tough time for them, regardless, before the poltergeist allegedly turns up.
Yes, indeed. And that's one of the really good things about Morris and Guy, because they didn't go in and just sort of try and record everything and be parapsychologists doing their job. Mm. They had genuine care for the family. And although the family did not get any sort of financial rewards from any of this, but certainly both Morris and Guy were very concerned about the health of the family and tried to make life as comfortable for them as possible, as well as trying to get rid of this damn thing that was giving them so much hassle.
Yeah, well, I think one of the key aspects of this, and I've I'd heard Guy mention this several times in the past whenever he's been asked about this case, was the arrival of the American demonologists, the Warrens. to say Guy's opinion of their involvement isn't positive, I think, is an understatement.
You said it, yes. we have on the tape, they are there on the tapes.
Mm.
So very briefly, because they weren't there very long at all.
Yep.
On one occasion, they can be heard trying to interview, I think it was Mr. Burkham and Guy. But one of them was interviewing, the other one was on the phone to an American company trying to get some sort of show off the ground. That was one occasion they were there. And on the other occasion, they upset the family quite a lot by taking out the two girls to a wimpy bar for a meal, but not the boys. And rather tongue in cheek, Mr. Burkham says at one point on the tape, and an awful lot of stuff seemed to happen whilst the Americans were there. They were not very popular at all. And of course, then The Conjuring 2 came out when they were the main investigators, and
oh,
we have nuns and crucifixes everywhere, and oh dear.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that I've always found incredibly frustrating about this case is that particular situation. And I wasn't aware. I knew they'd turned up originally and basically the Warrens had basically said to Guy, oh, we can make loads of money out of this. Everybody will be on to a winner. But like you say, Morris and Guy were simply there that they were more concerned with the family's health and well-being, far more than, you know, the potential to sort of expand their reputations or build a career off the back of this particular case.
Absolutely right, yes. I mean, as far as the two of them were concerned, they weren't doing it for the money because they weren't paid. That's the first point to make. Secondly, Morris was already an extremely successful inventor, numerous patents to his name, so he didn't need to promote himself at all. And Guy had got about a dozen or so books already out, so he wasn't trying to make a new book out of it or anything like that. But they had genuine concerns for the family, and they also wanted to try and get to grips with what on earth it was that was going on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interested me, and I know some people are big believers in coincidence, Dr. Willing, but obviously the situation with Morris Gross, with the fact that he'd lost his daughter in very tragic circumstances. Do you think that perhaps he needed the case as much as the Hodgsons needed his support as well?
I'm not sure about that. Some people have made quite a bit out of this, the fact that his daughter Janet died in this bad accident that she had. Mm. And then he goes along for his first investigation, by the way.
Yes.
And guess what? The girl is called Janet. So nice coincidence. Mm. I, knowing Morris as I did, I don't think he needed this case to do a link between that and his daughter particularly. Mm. Because, I mean, after all, it was Poltergeist. And Poltergeist is somewhat different from your average apparitional haunting. Mm. They tend to be very different things. So I don't think he was doing it for that reason. Now, having said that, towards the end of the case, one Dutch medium came along and visited, and he made a very strong link between Morris's daughter's death and the entity activity that was going on there. And after that, it ceased.
Mm.
So whether that is relevant and important, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that was always on. I mean, it would have been very interesting, because I don't think I've ever seen Morris really comment on being told that his daughter was responsible for it. Did he ever give you any indication of whether he believed the possibility of it being linked to his daughter at all?
He didn't. We did talk about this, and he didn't draw a lot of attention to it directly via Enfield. Mm. But he was certainly up for the idea that there was some sort of psychic connection still going on after the death of his daughter, not specifically towards Enfield, but in other respects he felt that there were sort of unusual incidences happening that could have been indicative of some sort of survival issue going on with his daughter, Janet.
Mm. Yeah, very much so. I mean, that, you know, as we briefly touched on as well about the Warren's second appearance. And I find it really interesting that for Guy and Morris, as far as they were concerned, it had near enough finished, hadn't it?
Yes. Absolutely.
And then the Warrens turn up and all of a sudden they have this mad event go on where loads of stuff happens in one day. And I think nobody really gives any of that any kind of credence. Do you?
Well, I wasn't there, but what I do know is that both Morris and Guy were very unhappy about the Warrens' appearance, that the family seemed to be unhappy about it. And it seems that they had a different set of criteria as to what they wanted to achieve with the case to what Morris and Guy had.
Yeah, very much so. Yes, very much so. I mean, I've never taken the time to bother watching The Conjuring 2, and I'll be brutally honest, I've no intention of watching it. So thank you for giving me an overview of it.
Well, it's a good film if you like Hammer horror type films.
Yeah.
Then great, you know, you'll jump quite a few times. Well, I did. but it bears very, very little relevance to the Enfield Poltergeist case.
Absolutely. And I mean, I've read their version of it. And if you didn't know anything about the actual case, you would go, blimey, this is very odd. But as you say, that film essentially makes out that they were the main investigators and it was all to do with this and that. And yet that their version of events bears no reality to the actual situation, does it?
Virtually none at all. I mean, there was a series that was on the television a few years ago, a three-part series,
yes.
Which had more relevance. But even they managed to leave out some quite important and interesting aspects and put in others that really didn't happen.
I mean, I watched the first episode of that. This case is something that I've loved reading about as long as I've been able to find anything about it. So I think the very first episode finishes with Guy Lyon Playfall being pinned to a wall by a ghost, and I just thought, what on earth is going on here?
Yes, that didn't happen, believe me.
Yeah, and I just thought, I can't understand why you would need, you know, as you refer to, very key incidents were not covered in this series, and they were replaced by, you know, flights of fancy, when for me I think the one thing about the Enfield is that you have such a volume of incidents that it didn't need elaboration.
Well, that happens so often, doesn't it, that actual sort of truth, whatever that is, of course, is more interesting than fiction. Fact is more interesting than fiction. It's a blatant example of that was in the three-part thing where, as we've just discussed, they left out things that were fascinating and put in things which just weren't true.
Mm. And it is frustrating because, for me, I think it's one of the best examples of a reality for this family that simply the story just needs to be told, and I think nothing else needs to be added, because, you know, as we referred to earlier, haunting such as this, it's the mundane aspects and the days when things don't happen that perhaps give it a bit more gravity to the whole event.
Yes, indeed, that's true. When I was listening to the tapes, I mean, 400 hours worth, it wasn't wham, bang, everything happens over and over again. There were great chunks of listening to what was on the television at that time, listening to them talking about school, children mucking about with each other and pinching each other, you know, the usual things that go on in a family with four young children there. Mm. And then, bang, something happens. They all scream and say, what on earth was that? A lot of bad language comes piling out and something's happened.
Well, yeah, I think that's the one thing because obviously I've heard some of the tapes, primarily in regards to the voices. And as you say, I've not had the pleasure of listening to more. So they were these alleged voices were rather offensive. With their choice of language, were they not?
Frequently, I wouldn't use the word rather. You know, I wouldn't be allowed to say some of the things that was being said on those tapes, notably by Janet, an 11-year-old girl who's going through sort of puberty at the time. And in her very deep voice, she is coming out with the sort of thing. I mean, I think it was Guy at one point, or maybe no, it was Morris, who said she sounds like a lavatory attendant on a particularly bad day. Not that we have anything against lavatory attendants.
No, let's clarify that point. Yes, no offence intended.
No, quite. But those were his words. They're not mine, of course. But you get the gist of it. You know, there was a lot of effing and blinding going on.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, when you started looking into that, and obviously, like I say, you've investigated phenomena such as this yourself.
Yeah.
Do you think that's given you the best grounding to kind of come in there? I mean, because what I love about the book and the fact that you state it quite categorically is, you know, this book is not designed to sway you either way. It is simply, these are the facts. This is the evidence on the tapes. These are the witness statements. Make of it what you will.
Yeah, that's the way I like to operate, because first of all, it's highly cowardly of me. because it means that, you know, if I come out with, yes, it's all genuine, and then a few years later somebody says, well, actually, no, we made it all up. Well, I don't get egg on my face from that. Mm. And if the opposite happens, I don't get egg on it as well, because I'm going down the middle. But having said that, I think it's important to just say, look, to the best of my ability, this is what was recorded in this instance in audio tape. You can listen to it. You can decide for yourself. I've got my opinions, but they're just my opinions. And hey, I might change my opinion in years to come, and I might be wrong as well.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, obviously, since you've created the book and gone through this, have you had any sort of recent correspondence with Janet and Margaret, or have they? Because the other thing that's always surprised me about this, especially in the modern era, is that they're very, very reluctant to talk to anybody about this in public anymore. They just don't do anything.
Well, I didn't manage to get any details for Margaret, so I didn't manage to make any sort of contact with her. I did write to Janet a few times, but because I managed to get her address, and unfortunately she didn't reply. In fact, I did, when Guy had his funeral, which was about 14 months ago, I contacted Janet to say if she wanted a lift, if she wanted to go to the funeral and wanted a lift, I'd give her one, because she only lives about an hour's drive away from me. Mm. But there was no reply from her. So for whatever reason, she decided that she didn't want to make any sort of contact with me, which is fair enough. Mm. They have both, around about the time that The Conjuring 2 was released, they did make some statements on television, and there is video footage of them talking about the evidence and how that they were sticking to their beliefs that these things really did happen, without them supporting too much The Conjuring 2.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I remember, I think, that the best overall documentary I've seen about it, I think Channel 4 did one about 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. About 2007, which I know Guy wasn't very keen on, even so. But I think other than that, and like you say, the brief media appearances during The Country, it would be easier for them to come out and promote it more, especially when you look at, you know, certain cases, the money certain cases generate. You know, you can get on the lecture circuit in the States if you play your cards right, you know who's who. They've never embraced that, and that also kind of gives a bit more credence to some of the incidents, not all of it, obviously. But what do you think? Because do you think it would be easier for them to have absorbed it and said, yeah, you know, let's run with this and see how much we can make?
Well, I think possibly and maybe even probably. They could have made more of it if they'd wanted to and had some money coming in from various sources. They haven't to date done that. I mean, that's not saying in the future they might. I don't know. It might be they just want a quieter life, that they're slightly embarrassed by all those things that happened to them, whether they were done intentionally or whether they were done unintentionally. I mean, some of it was pretty embarrassing, actually, to be dragged up if I was to play.
Welcome to Kraken Mare, the biggest liquid hydrocarbon ocean on Saturn's moon Titan.
And this is just one of the places you get to visit and learn about when you listen to the Hostile Worlds podcast.
The Hostile Worlds podcast, which is, of course, a science-based audio drama documentary series that teaches you all about our universe in a fun and entertaining way.
Head on over to hostileworlds.net to subscribe on your podcast app of choice.
Parts of the tapes now publicly, which I wouldn't do. I think anybody who's now in their 50s would be very embarrassed by what they were saying and doing when they were children.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, I mean, and I don't understand why I didn't really kind of pick up on this. One of the things that I spotted in your book was obviously they had the issues with the urine and the excrement appearing all over the house.
Well, not all over the house.
No. Was it mostly in the bathroom?
In the bathroom, yes.
Yes, thank God. But, and I've never picked up on this before, you pointed out that some of the urine was taken away to be tested, and it was a cat.
Yes, yes. John Burkham, who was working in a hospital at the time, he evidently took some of it away, and it was cat's urine.
Yet no one, I mean, obviously the Hodgsons didn't have a cat, did they? They had a goldfish and a budgerigar, I believe.
Yes.
And nobody ever mentioned seeing a cat at any point, do they?
No, not that I'm just thinking in case I'm giving false information, but I don't think it's ever mentioned on a tape that there's a sort of, oh, look, there's the cat, let's stroke the cat or anything like that.
Yeah, and to be fair, as a cat owner, cats tend to make themselves tend to vocalise at the worst possible moment. So if you've got 400 hours of recordings, yeah, I would suggest that there would be several meows and caterwaulings upon them.
Unless they were scared of the bits of Lego flying through the air.
well, usually. I mean, that's the other thing, because, I mean, obviously, the fact that there was a couple of pets there, it just seems that they didn't seem to be that, because obviously when we talk about hauntings and things like that, there are often people will say that their dogs or their cats start acting oddly in certain parts of the house, or they, you know, they stare at the walls or certain parts of the house, or the dog will bark. There doesn't seem to be any kind of response in the animals in that situation, which I've always found quite peculiar as well when you compare it with, you know, other stories of haunted locations.
Yes, I don't think, apart from Janet barking like a dog, which she frequently did, I don't think that either the budgerigar or the goldfish were particularly fazed by any of the activity there. And there were no real dogs or cats in the household, as far as I know.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't that kind of area where, oh, that, you know, people would say, oh, well, we can hear a dog barking. Oh, it's clearly, you know, number 27's dog or whatever. There's no explanation in regards to anybody, you know, having a dog in the area, regardless of whether you believe that, the, you know, the barking is emanating from one of the children or not.
Yeah. No, I mean, the barking definitely came from Janet. I mean, she was opening her mouth and barking like a dog. So there was no idea that there's a sort of a ghostly dog barking in a different room or something. I mean, she would bark out Morris's name. I mean, you hear on the tapes quite frequently her sort of using a barking voice to say his name rather than the male gruff voice that we all know and love.
Mm, yeah, very much so. I mean, in regards to that as well, because obviously I think the most famous one is the voice that claims to be called Bill.
Yeah.
And I think most people who are involved in this case or are fans of this case, and I count myself among, like to think that we can all do a pretty good impression of that voice. When you've been looking at the tapes, what's the longest sort of conversation or continuation of Bill or some of the other voices? Because obviously the big thing about this is surely an 11-year-old girl can't be putting this voice on because of the, you know, the damage it can cause to anybody's throat.
Yeah. There was a few misconceptions about this, which I discovered on the tapes. Morris and Guy both said that they never complained of having a sore throat, even though they were doing these voices. Mm. And don't forget, by the way, Margaret was doing the voices as well as Janet. It was just mainly Janet, but a bit of Margaret as well. But in fact, they did complain about having sore throats occasionally. And you can hear them saying, but I've got a sore throat sort of thing. But that aside, it wasn't as much as you would imagine it would be for all of this grunting and groaning that they were doing. As far as the length of the time that they kept it going, I think the longest amount of time was probably about half an hour of virtually constant backwards and forwards in conversation, with Morris using his normal voice to ask them questions, etc., and then Janet replying in her Bill voice, or, by the way, any of the other people, because it wasn't just Bill.
Mm.
There was Fred and Joe and a whole host of other names that she came out with. Quite a selection.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the other outstanding aspects of your book is that attention to detail, Dr. William, because, like you say, the misconception is the ghost was called Bill. He was the only one that came through either of the girls, and that was that. But I think, you know, offhand, there's at least... Is it 20 sort of people that claim to have come forward?
It could well be that number. I mean, initially, before the voices came through, there was sort of contact via rapping. Mm. So Morris would say, you know, 3 raps for yes, 2 raps for no, or whatever it happened to be. And they had a person coming through, a female, actually, was the first point of contact, which gave her name, and then she changed her name to something else. This was discovered through rapping to give out what the letters were of her name.
Mm.
But the voices were all male voices. There were no female voices that came through Janet at all.
Yeah, and that also is one of those things that surely it would be easier for a girl to pretend to be a woman than it would be a man.
Yes, one would have thought so. But in many possession cases... And of course, this isn't the first, and it probably won't be the last, where something weird is happening.
Mm.
It tends to be the male voice that comes through, whether it's another male doing it or a female.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. I mean, it's the other good thing, you know, and as you've touched on throughout this conversation, you've tried to have an update and communicate with you know, more recently with some of the people. I was surprised to read your conversation with Graham Morris, the photographer from the Daily Mirror, I believe, at the time. Because when I saw him interviewed a few years ago on the Channel 4 programme, he was quite dismissive about the thing. Now, that could be bad editing, that could be, you know, having a chance to it. But when I looked at your conversation with him, he seems to have kind of drifted back a little bit that, yes, he does suspect that perhaps there was a bit of mischief going on. But he thinks that, you know, some of it, quite a lot of it, was strange.
Yes, I strongly got that impression from him in our phone conversation. And he said to me that I could quote him on this, so I wasn't sort of making anything up or anything. And he seemed to think exactly as you've just said, and as I reported in the book, that, yeah, of course, there was some fooling about, but some of it he found inexplicable.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those things my parents at the time got the Daily Mirror. So I actually saw it, you know, whoever thinks letting a 6-year-old kid read about poltergeists is a good idea, especially when on a tangent, we'd lived in a very spooky house growing up. And we just moved away from it at the same time. So it's a bit interesting that kind of caught the zeitgeist at the same time as that. But obviously, the gentleman, I think the original reporter that went was a gentleman called George Fallows.
Yeah.
He seemed to have been rather ahead of his time in regards to the fact that rather than think, oh, I can, you know, rubbing his hands going, oh, that's it, we've made it, we've got the story of the century here. One of the first things he does is phone the Society for Psychical Research and said, I've got a family here, they need help.
Yes, he did that, and good for him, especially considering that, you know, there were big stories here to be made on in newspapers. But instead, he went to an august society that takes these things very seriously and said, look, we're out of our depth here. Perhaps you'd better send one of your people along, hence Morris going along, and Guy, and numerous other members of the society.
Mm. I mean, I think it was there's a lot of coincidences in regards to this, because I believe that when Morris kind of asks for assistance here, were they actually at the society? I think had actually just done a lecture on poltergeists, and it was that catalyst that brought Guy into the situation. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Morris had been to the house a few days before, I think, and bizarrely, another one of these nice coincidences, the talk that evening was being held at the SPR was on poltergeist. You couldn't make this up. And Morris stood up in his usual forthright way and said, well, I'm investigating a case and, you know, it's this, and I could do with some help here. And two people actually agreed to help him. One was Guy Playfair, who was about to go on holiday, but he ended up cancelling his holiday.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other was a dentist or a dental surgeon who also said he would go along and help. And he went along a few times and got some information, some phenomena happened. He's subsequently died, alas. Mm. But after that, after a few days stroke weeks, it was Guy and Morris that were really sort of leading on this.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, like you say, it is peculiar because obviously Guy's obviously mentioned that fact that he'd just gone along to this lecture because he'd just finished a book and he was drained and he was just thinking, oh, I just need to get away and recharge my batteries and everything. And then the next thing he thinks, oh, what the hell? I've got nothing, you know, let's cancel this holiday for 15 months and let's dive straight into this.
Yes, well, Guy would have done that because he was fascinated with poltergeists virtually all his life. I mean, he investigated a load of them in Brazil when he was there. Mm. And he was astounded by some of the phenomena that he witnessed in Brazil, because he talked to me about it frequently.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting kind of overlap throughout this, because it's the one part of the paranormal that I've always gravitated to more, because it's these cases are extremely rare in the modern era especially, and to have got a level of investigation that we do have, regardless of the veracity of all of it, is it one of those things that perhaps we need another Enfield case to be, you know, in the modern era? Because I'm racking my brains to try and think of anything similar on a similar level in recent years. I mean, there were cases that happened around the same time. Have you come across anything similar in the last few years in the UK or even further abroad, Dr. William, that is even comparable?
Evidently, there are still numerous cases happening, notably in other countries, in Asian countries, for instance, where they or in South American countries, where they are more open to a spirit sort of intervention in their daily lives rather than in our sort of different world that we live in here in the West, perhaps. There are occasional investigations that still take place to this day. But the problem is it's a lot easier to fake them now, and so one has to be extremely careful when you attend a similar case to make sure that there's not just complete faking going on for financial reasons, perhaps. A lot of people have stars in their eyes, they want their 15 minutes of television, etc. And so one has to be very, very careful, more careful than ever about discussing and investigating cases.
Yeah, very much so. I think there's a lot of comparison for me with the explosion at the beginning of the 20th century with the psychics and people sort of presenting visitations and ectoplasm and things like that, with the modern, obviously, situation we've got these days, is that, you know, you can put something on YouTube and you can be, you know, you can make a packet out of it. It, you know, very, very quickly, depending on the quality of your footage. Do you think that we need to be far more vigilant than we are currently, because certain, as you've referred to there, it is certainly easier to sort of manipulate footage.
Yes, I think we have to be extra careful. There's a nice saying that people often say, and that is, please be open-minded, but not so open-minded that your brains fall out. Therefore, I mean, I rather like that one. It's not my invention, that term. And I think, yes, I mean, let's be open-minded to the possibility. We don't know it all, for, after all. So science is always being updated to encompass new stuff that's been discovered. So let's try and convert some of our alleged paranormal things into normal things by understanding them, but be very careful in the process.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, think of a prime example. I don't know if you've seen this. The last couple of weeks, there was the woman who claimed to have filmed this gnome running about outside her house. And if you take
sure
the time...
You what,
sorry, Dr. William?
I said, I'm sure it happened.
Well, it's a child running about at 3 a.m. But because she's this video has just gone from, you know, zero to a million miles away, because it just spread around the world overnight, she was still sticking to this point till people started saying, well, you can see the child's wearing flip-flops. And even her own family were saying, oh, I see your kids mucking about again.
Are you implying that gnomes don't wear flip-flops?
I'm afraid I am. I think, you know, I'm not going to criticise the sartorial elegance of the gnome world, Dr. William, but I can't say I'm up to date with what the fashions are out there at the moment for gnomes. But I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, you see the duende videos from South America as well, where, you know, little things just seem to be dragged along the floor by rather conspicuously seen pieces of string. But I think it is. I think it's as frustrating now as it probably was 100 years ago when you had people claiming, you know, to be producing ectoplasm.
The problem with that is that if there is genuine things going on, then people now will say, well, of course, it's all been faked anyway.
Well, that, yeah, exactly. And it is as difficult, I think, not just in the paranormal field, because obviously I'm a big fan of cryptozoology, and that is just ripe for hoaxing on a massive scale, you know, across the world, which is, you know, disappointing and frustrating, and you know, especially probably more so for someone like yourself with the position you have.
Well, I had great fun for a year writing a book on cryptozoology. A film called Monsters Caught on Film. Yeah. I didn't want to call it Monsters, but the publisher did. and I found some of them hilariously funny and unbelievable, and some of them really interesting and probably worthy of a lot more support by hard science.
Very much so. I think that's it. And to be fair, that's how I first became aware of who you were, because I actually have that book.
Oh, good.
And I think you did one on ghosts, which I bought my mother as
yes.
well. So I was delighted I wonder if it's the same gentleman. And it was, because obviously it mentions both books in your introduction in the Enfield book. So, I recommend both of those books especially well. But, yeah, your Monsters one is interesting, because, you know, there have been some horrendous things. But that, once again, you know, you even have to go back to 100 years to look at the, you know... the monkey incident in South America, and was it Larissa's ape, I believe?
Yes.
It is. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's 100 years ago and people are still arguing about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, so they should, because the more people maybe discuss rather than argue,
yeah.
then perhaps more information comes out. And if the argument or the discussion is good enough, perhaps some people that are heavily one side of the argument might dip a toe a little bit towards the other side. And before you know it, more information is available.
Absolutely. And I'm of the feeling that I find it quite frustrating when science just basically closes any of these subjects down as nonsense, because that's not what my interpretation of what science should be doing. I think we can only progress and understand these things more by, you know, having rigorous scientific analysis and investigation across a whole realm of wonderful phenomena. And I think some of these subjects deserve probably more scrutiny than they're currently getting at the moment. What do you think?
Yes, I think the good science, real science, should be looking at things and trying to work out what's going on, not just closing their door on it and saying, no, it's all rubbish, we don't believe a word of it, goodbye.
Very true. So in regards to Enfield then, looking back and after your fabulous book, which I can't recommend highly enough, for me it's one of the cases, where would you put it in the pantheon of British poltergeist cases? Because, you know, there are two or three I can think of that are probably of similar stature and fierceness, but certainly nothing that seems to have gone on as long. Where do you think this case sits in British parapsychological history now?
Well, I think that it's probably the best investigated case that there has been, that's been recorded in the way in which it's been recorded. That's as of this moment in time. So there may be another case that's about to be unleashed on us that's going to be even better. Mm. But as far as my knowledge is concerned, I think because of the amount of time, because of the amount of effort, the quality of the investigation that went on over this long period, about 18 months, the number of people that were brought in, the methodology used, I think that it's probably the best one that there's been.
Mm, very much so. So after this, what's next for you? Have you got anything else planned, or are you continuing to investigate any other cases, or where does your eye fall next?
Well, I'm always doing a lot of archive work for the Society for Psychical Research, and so constantly people give me boxes of things, or they say, can you have a look at this? A few years ago, there was a big black metal box I discovered and said, you know, does anybody know what's in there? And no. And it was full of 19th century envelopes on precognition that had never been opened. Some of them were wax sealed. And we opened them up, myself and Donald West, a fairly famous criminologist. Mm. We opened them up together and found some fascinating information inside. These things are always happening. And there's a few archive things that are on the cards at the moment, which I won't mention yet. Mm. That I know are coming soon.
Yeah. Well, I'm incredibly envious of your position, because I can imagine that. I mean, to be fair, I'd be one of those people. I'd find a box and I'd probably not shift until I'd gone through the entire box. I'd probably lose a day at least. just reading and absorbing everything. So is that something you're still getting then? Are you still getting people sending in old correspondence and discovering treasure troves of such things in attics and lost in back cupboards and stuff?
That's a really easy question to answer with a big yes. it happens, I won't say every week, but probably every month or so, somebody contacts and says, I had one a few weeks ago. We've just done some decorating and we were having a bash at a wall, and behind the wall we found a carrier bag full of things, and they've got the SPR logo on them. Would you like them? We kind of forgotten they were there from 50, 60 years ago. So, oh, yes, please. And so you go through all this correspondence that we had no records of until that moment. That's just one example.
Wow. That's even strange. Why you would board that up behind a wall anyway?
It was a mistake.
Thank goodness.
Builders had chucked it there to get it out of the way, and then somebody had come along and put some boarding across it, and yeah, there you go.
Oh, fantastic. Just a continuing treasure trove of newly discovered delights then.
Yes, I'm waiting for a Shakespeare play to come out.
Yeah, very true. Or, a lost Harry Price investigation or something like that, perhaps. But
I'll see you in Bermuda if that happens.
Well, as long as you remember, remember the people that have been very nice to you over the years. So, you know, going forwards, where can people find a copy of your book and follow you, and if any other indications or links that you have, sir?
Yeah, thank you. Well, Amazon is obviously selling it. So Amazon, they will do it in electric form, or they'll do it in a normal hard copy form. And general bookshops, although they may not supply it, they may not have it in stock, but they can always get hold of it. If people want sort of copies from me, signed copies or that sort of stuff, they can always get it via me. If they contact you, because I believe you have your details posted abroad, so to speak, if they contact you and then you contact me, we can do it that way.
No, brilliant. Yeah, I'll certainly put a link on, because obviously I always put in my show notes the links to people's information. So I'll certainly put my email address and ask, you know, if anybody wants to do it that way, by all means, I'll ask them to email me and then I'll forward them on. That would be absolutely fine from my side.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm quite happy to do that, because, I mean, to be honest, if they just put my unusual name in a search for Google, they'll probably come across me anyway.
Yeah, brilliant. So, I mean, one of the other aspects I want, just before I let you go, is as someone that's always thrived and been delighted with discussing and investigating and reading about these things, what's the possibility of someone visiting the SPR archives and seeing some of the work that's there? Is there any facility for the general public to visit them, or are they just purely available on a need to know net basis?
No, there are two ways of doing it, really. The London Library in West Kensington. Now that has numerous books. Now these are meant for members of the Society for Psychical Research, but if somebody turns up and wants to have a look and they're thinking about joining, then that's not a problem, but they should always contact the office there first. But anybody at Cambridge University Library is where the main archive is. Now anybody that has a reader's card there for the Cambridge University Library can have access to the SPR files there. And anybody that gets a recommendation from the Society for Psychical Research or myself, they can then visit there and they will be allowed to order up from the bowels of the library anything they want to look at. And they can even have it copied by the university library there for a small fee. So, I mean, they are certainly available to the public at large.
Ah, fantastic, fantastic. Well, it is something I'm interested in, because I'm currently trying my damnedest to finish a book off in regards to a poltergeist case in the 1950s, which seems to have completely disappeared off the radar in the UK. And I was just interested to see if there's any kind of correspondence there, because I'm not really sure if the SPR were involved in the case at all. So I might be something I'll send you an email about and see if you can point me in the right direction at some point.
Yes, do that, because the archive at Cambridge is massive. And it's not just SPR material, it's other material that people have donated to the SPR. And we normally then say, thank you very much, and I catalogue it, or the people there catalogue it. And it may not be an SPR case, it may be somebody else's case, or it may just be somebody that's written in with information that they want to be housed somewhere secure.
Perfect. Brilliant. Well, listen, absolutely fabulous to speak to you today. It's, like I say, it's a wonderful book, so congratulations on that, and I wish you all the success in the world with it. I hope you sell many copies of it, because I think it's a book, if you're interested in the paranormal or psychic research or anything, or poltergeist or anything, for me, I think it's an essential addition to the history of poltergeist, and especially this particular case, Dr. Willin, and all power to you for your work and diligent research on it.
Well, thank you very much for a fascinating interview that we've shared together.
You're very welcome. So thank you again for your time. All power to you, and hopefully we'll speak again sometime.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Yeah, bye.
Let me hear you say my name. Come on, let me hear you say my name. That's not my name. Come on, my name's Morris. Let me hear you say it.
Morris.
Say Dr. Belloc. Come on, let me hear you say that. Come on, let's hear you say Dr. Belloc. Say Dr. Belloc. Now, if you squeak the bed, I can't hear you talking. Now, say Dr. Belloc. Come on. Come on, say it for me, Dr. Belloc.
Dr. Belloc. Right, that's good. Come on. Shut up, don't you? happen to have prayed of. And I have cried to the church where Rina lives. And all my friends come from there as well. And people make a game and go to the pub. And then we pick your house. But I used to live here. And I will tell you the law. And if you don't get anyone else, just take Mr. Hook and Mr. Blayback.
I want you to tell me whether you remember what happened to you when you died. Just before you died and just after you died.
So, what you're saying is we could get rid of you by praying to God?
Yes.